Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll speak with John Amato about civility, or the lack thereof. We'll be joined by Imani Gandhi and Jessica Mason Piclo from Rewire.News to talk about the happenings at the Supreme Court, the future of Roe v. Wade. And then we'll be joined by Todd Tucker. He's a Roosevelt Institute fellow. And we'll talk to him about trade, Trump's trade madness. But first, this week, actually the last couple of weeks, has just been one gut punch after the other. The Supreme Court ruled that, issued rulings upholding gerrymandering, restrictions on voting rights. They allowed crisis pregnancy centers, these fraudulent anti-choice operations to deceive people. They allowed people to rip off unions with the Janus decision, basically making the whole public sector a right to rip off a union. They upheld the Muslim ban. It's one thing after another. My friend Todd Gitlin, my internet friend Todd Gitlin, wrote at the Washington Post, and I quote, "One has to go back almost a half of a century to find a month like the past one, so devastating to the left and its values," unquote. Everything is awful, and if you feel like the very worst people in this country, just the most venal, ignorant, and obnoxious people, scored three touchdowns on you in the last 5 minutes, you're not alone. It's so easy to be demoralized. It's been a demoralizing week. So before we get on with the show, I just wanted to share some words from Representative John Lewis. Lewis, you know, is a civil rights icon. He's faced down fire hoses and police dogs and racist cops with nightsticks, and he's been keeping up that fight for the last 60 years. He wrote this week, and I quote, "Do not get lost in a sea of despair. Be hopeful, be optimistic. Our struggle is not the struggle of a day, a week, a month, or a year. It is the struggle of a lifetime. Never, ever be afraid to make some noise and get in good trouble. Necessary trouble," end quote. We don't have the luxury of despair. There is no alternative to fighting on, so fight on we must. Stay tuned, we'll take a quick break and then be right back.
Takes it back to Molly waiting at the door, and as
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland. I'm joined now by John Amato. John is a rock star. He is also the progressive media mogul. He's the founder of Crooks and Liars, which allows me to park my show at their joint, for which I'm grateful. John Amato, welcome back to the show.
Always good to join you, my friend.
You are a very civil person. We've had this great debate about civility in like over the last 2-3 weeks. And then some guy walked into a newspaper and shot it up. And it's just, this was a couple of days after Milo, what is his name? Milo.
Yeah. The
creepy weirdo.
Yiannopoulos.
Yes. That very hard to pronounce name. He said he couldn't wait for, vigilantes to start shooting up journalists. Now he's suing the journalists who, well, he says he's suing the journalists who reported that. I don't know. There is a argument to be made, a valid argument, or one that at least has to be grappled with, which is that right now we have a Democratic base that's really fired up over Trump, fired up over baby prisons, et cetera, et cetera. And there is a risk of this kind of ostracization of Trumpers. And I should add that I'm talking about the Red Hen thing. I'm talking about Maxine Waters saying that Trumpers should be spontaneously protested wherever they go, et cetera, et cetera. That these types of confrontational tactics run the risk of firing up Trump supporters and ultimately backfiring. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't think you can predict how any situation's going to turn out. I mean, who could have predicted where we are today? And so for these arbiters, you know, the villagers, we call them, these arbiters of good behavior and civility, to now say that we are supposed to treat some nefulous, some weird, you know, idea of what a Trump supporter is and be kind to them and nice and handle them with kid gloves, because if we, you know, if we hurt their fifis, they may not vote the correct. It's just crazy. You know, it's like Trump's rhetoric, Trump's behavior is really, you know, I wrote a piece on it, you know, with this whole civility debate, which he's cracking the country. I mean, it didn't start with Trump, and it's been going on for a long time, but he's the first politician to amplify what AM hate radio has been doing since 1986.
Right.
And so he's definitely not the first person, but he's taken the office of the president to such a low level, rhetoric-wise, that it's, you know, the effect that you're going to have is people being very angry. You know, when the rise of then Senator Barack Obama, when he was running for, you know, in the primaries, the Democratic primaries, you could see the sort of racism start to bleed out from the Republican Party, and then it basically coalesced around the Tea Party movement. I mean, Obama was, you know, not in office less than a month, and right in February, the announcement of these Tea Party protests were going on, and the absolute racism and you wanted to call incivility that came out of those protests was insane. But yet we have to get really upset at Michelle Wolf for making a Aunt Lydia joke about Sarah Sanders.
Yeah, listen, here's the thing. Incivility, I think we can all agree, is not a great thing to have. And I think that there is a coarsening of the discourse that's resulted not only from Trump, but just from our increasing polarization. Now, if you go and you look at, Pew did a study, and I think it was called something about partisan animosity. You can Google it, Pew partisan animosity. And what this found was that on every single measure, Republicans and Republican-leaning independents are slightly more intolerant, slightly, not significantly, slightly more intolerant of people with opposing views than Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents. So you have this problem, and you have data which shows that it's a little bit more severe on the conservative within the conservative movement and that whole coalition. And yet we're having this whole conversation about liberal incivility, that is incivility on, as if it's something that is a problem for one side. John, I guess I would just ask you, like, what role does the conservative media play in that disconnect between that reality, that is, we're really intolerant of opposing views and conservatives are a little bit more, and the fact that there's this discussion in the mainstream media about how intolerant liberals are?
Yeah, it's just a total disconnect of reality. You know, Kellyanne Conway, you know, basically gave away the goods when she talked about, well, we have alternative facts, and that's what they use. I mean, the role of conservative media, the conservarazzi, as sometimes I call them, you know, they've been amplifying this liberal bias, you know, ever since Nixon, really, but, you know, with the advent of Fox News and then getting rid of the fairness doctrine so that right-wing talk radio could dominate the airwaves. You know, playing the victim is probably the number one focus of a conservatism. Forget policies, forget the deficits we now see. They could care less.
Deficits are a problem when Democrats do them.
Right. But it's all about playing the victim and victimhood. And Mr. Frank wrote some great books on whatever happened to Kansas. And he's got some really great takes on the idea of backlash politics and the idea that they're always the victim. You know, they hold the House, the Senate, the presidency, but somehow they're the victims.
Yes.
And so when the president decides to get rid of the DACA protections that President Obama had put forth, it's not his fault. It's the Democrats.
Right.
And so it's always this victimization that it inspires and fuels a lot of conservative voters, but it's really destroying the country at its core at this point.
And it's the problem when the mainstream press, like, you expect the conservative press to do what the conservative press does. It's the real problem is when the mainstream press internalizes those narratives. You know, the thing that I was thinking about when I asked you that question is that if you watch Fox News, if you read whatever conservative
I
websites,
do watch a lot of Fox News.
I know you should get combat pay for that.
How's
your brain not turned to mush? What they do is they will take non-stories and make them into major stories. Like, some guy, some obnoxious jerk with a MAGA hat will get thrown out of a restaurant. This happened in Florida, I think, right? Got thrown out of, well, maybe they didn't even throw him out. Maybe he just got, like, rude service or something, right? And I personally think there's probably more to the story. I think he probably had an attitude. But, you know, people get thrown out of bars and restaurants all the time. It's not a big deal. It's not a major news story. It's not a cable news story. And yet they will play that on a loop. They'll do these things where, like, someone, you know, says something mean to some conservative and it's a big story. And that's a constant. That's a constant in the conservative media, those kinds of, you
Absolutely.
Know, they're no. totally boring. They're nothing burgers, but they make them into a big thing. And when you have that 24/7, and then you take people in the mainstream media, who are probably somewhat liberal on social issues, they have their urbanites, they live on the coasts, et cetera, et cetera. And they feel, oh my God, maybe I'm, you know, I need to compensate for my own, you know, I have to be careful to avoid my own biases. So I'm going to take this narrative seriously. You know, people are being mean to conservatives and they just don't see that conservatives give it and they take it.
Yeah, it is a problem. I don't know. At times I wonder, it's not like the media has not reported on Trump's xenophobia, his racism, his rhetoric, his antics. But it's such a constant flow every day. You know, we could write 10 stories on just how awful that the conservatives act. Before, by the way, if you go back when I first started blogging back in 2004 or writing, he's the only person out there, or one of the only people that was really making noise on TV in this type of respect was Ann Coulter. She was sort of a star. She was on Fox News, and she would make outrageous claims. But most of the politicians that went on TV still tried to remain, quote, civil.
Yes.
Now, you know, we forward fast now, and Ann Coulter is a blip on the scale of incivility, and House members and senators act twice as mean as she does in their capacity. And I think it's turned the mainstream media, lots of hosts, they're not sure. I don't know. It's hard to process this type of behavior that's an onslaught. And so when they can find a sliver of the, you know, one Democratic representative that nobody ever heard of in the country outside of if you're in California, and to make her the new boogeyman, right?
Yes.
She's the reason, you know, as Sean Hannity said, why this person, you know, why this man went in and killed five people at the Capitol Gazette. And even Mark Short uttered her name when on MSNBC, when Haley Jackson was discussing, you know, the tax policies. And then she closed asking him that, is it time for Trump to stop telling everybody that journalists are the enemy of the people? He opens up with, well, you know, I don't want to get political, but maybe you should talk to Maxine Waters.
Ugh, yeah, yeah.
And it's, you know, and Kate, you know, and Haley Jackson was at the end of the segment, so I don't think she really had much time. She did said, I don't see, you know, the point you're making with that. And then, she had to close out the segment. But I think they have a real problem trying to process just the volume of the lies and the incivility that comes out of conservatives and the Trump administration, and how to deal with that when, you know, isolated instances of the left come out in response to throwing children in cages. You know, that I'm not sure they know what to do at times.
I'm not sure I know what to do at times. I mean, one of the things that Trump, I think, has mastered is the ability to just, you know, overwhelm us with the volume of outrages. There is such a thing as outrage fatigue. And sometimes I just can't process this latest thing. Like, I just think, oh my God, all right, I'm just going to let it go. You know, there are some times when I look at Trump's attacking somebody in this ridiculous way, or telling the American people some ridiculous lie, some like ludicrous lie, and I just think, okay, whatever, it's just the president being the president. And it is hard to maintain a rigorous rigorous coverage of this administration, because he just is a fire hose. He's just a gusher of incivility, if you will, offensive, demagogic, you know, rhetoric, and it can be utterly overwhelming.
That's what makes our job now even more important, by trying to get through this this thickness, this, you know, of just constant tidal waves and tsunamis of lies and exaggerations and misstatements. Half the time he's not lying, he just doesn't know what he's talking about.
Right.
So he just throws anything out there, but it has to make us more vigilant and to keep up and not let it fall by the wayside. You know, when I first started, after we would cover some of this stuff on Fox News, the constant refrain I got from people is, why even bother covering this? You know, why even give them the light of day? Because you can see what was happening. This was going to be the end result. And now we still have to double down and be even more vigilant.
I agree with you. Folks, read John at Crooks and Liars. Also, speaking of like keeping up with things, I do a weekly column at Raw Story called What Fresh Hell? And it's a roundup of outrageous things that I think got lost in the shuffle each week. Check that out too. John, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really do appreciate it.
My pleasure, always.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then talk about the complete debacle to come at the Supreme Court.
His
I'm still Joshua Holland. I am joined by two excellent legal journalists, analysts, Jessica Mason Plico and Imani Gandhi. They are the legal team, I guess, at Rewire.news. They also host the podcast Boom Lawyered, which you should absolutely check out. Ladies, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Joshua.
Yeah, thanks so much.
So this is has been a completely demoralizing week at the Supreme Court, capped off. So there was this series of awful rulings, Janus among the chief among them, I think. And that was the one that basically gutted public employees unions. It made a right to rip off a union laws, what the right calls right to work laws. Basically the law of the land for public service workers, and they went far beyond what I think a lot of labor experts were expecting. And then that was capped off by the resignation of our so-called swing justice. It's just so terrible. Let me ask you this, before we even get into the questions of like what happens next, how are you... I'm feeling this feeling that the worst people in the world have beaten me. I've been fighting this sense of demoralization. Are you feeling the same thing? And how are you managing that?
Yeah, I'm definitely feeling like I've been fighting and screaming and yelling about the Supreme Court for years. And I've gotten so much pushback, especially from some factions of the left. And I feel as if, like, y'all, I wish y'all would have listened to me, because here we are. We're at this moment. We are at this place where I really feared that we would be years ago. And it was entirely preventable, I think. And so I am slightly optimistic, because it does seem like a lot of people understand that we are in such a dire situation. And I think a lot of people who never really before considered joining the fight or actually, you know, protesting or doing anything really concrete and sort of forward thinking, because that's the sort of stuff that we're going to need right now. I find a lot of people who've never thought about that before are actually thinking about that. And that includes stuff like, you know, stockpiling Plan B or opening up your home for pregnant people who need to leave their own state to get an abortion because their states have outlawed them, which is coming. I mean, a lot of it is very saddening and it makes my heart heavy, but I'm a fighter, and so I'm not going to stop fighting.
We really don't have a choice. That's the thing. When I feel demoralized, I think, well, you know, at least I am someone who enjoys a lot of privilege in different ways. I have a college education. I'm white. I'm a dude. You know, like, you just can't. I mean, whether you like it or not, we almost have an imperative to fight. Jessica, do you think this is the potential silver lining in that, you know, what happened with Neil Gorsuch is that, and of course, Garland before him, is that the right has been fighting for the courts for 30 years without a concerted pushback from the other side. And they've invested tons of money. They've built institutions, the Federalist Society, et cetera, et cetera. And this has been a playing field that has basically been not entirely abandoned by Democrats and progressives and the left, but pretty much. Is this the potential silver lining that people are like, oh, my God, this is what everybody, this was the worst fears realized?
I certainly hope so, because we need something, right? I mean, Imani is exactly right, and your synopsis is on the money, that this is a campaign that the right has launched effectively since the civil rights decisions of the Brennan Court. So it's been decades now, and they realized immediately that they had two fronts that they had to win, in the court of public opinion and in the federal judiciary, and they have captured the courts. We have an open seat, and there's still the possibility to fight for it and to get, hopefully, a nominee that isn't terrible, but, you know, it's going to be a really long haul. And when we're talking about the implications of what's at stake here, I mean, we're already seeing the Trump administration's policies play out and in real time with devastating consequences. And the one firewall that we have had so far is the federal courts, and they had blocked the worst of his opinions and his policies so far. And with Kennedy's, what we saw with the end of this term is that the Supreme Court's more or less willing to roll over for that with Kennedy. So the question I think we have to ask then is, how far along on that conservative trajectory will the conservatives go with a new addition, someone who is likely more conservative even than where Kennedy landed, someone who aligns much more with Thomas and Gorsuch?
To what degree are we pinning our hopes? Like, is our last hope the idea that John Roberts cares about the integrity of the institution to such a degree that he will be hesitant to risk delegitimizing it with a large swath of the population? Or let me ask you this, maybe I should put it a little bit differently. Like, does John Roberts sit down and write an opinion that says Roe v. Wade is now overturned?
I personally am not sure if that's the case. Jess may have a different answer, but whether or not he actually writes those words down isn't particularly relevant, because what is going to happen is states are going to start mimicking each other when it comes to passing laws, very restrictive abortion laws. And so it's going to become whether or not these laws can stand under the standards that we have already developed in cases like Planned Parenthood versus Casey and Whole Woman's Health. So the court doesn't need to flat out overrule Roe in order to make abortion absolutely inaccessible to most of the population in this country.
Yeah, Imani's right that they don't need to. I will say a couple things for context. Chief Justice John Roberts has never cast a vote in favor of abortion rights in the duration of his time on the bench at any level. So we are very clear on where he stands on this. And in terms of the respect for the institution of the court, that was a reputation that I think Roberts developed in part because of his vote to uphold the Affordable Care Act way back in what feels like four lifetimes ago. But since then, we've seen he is more than willing to upend precedent when it serves political purposes. And we have a couple really clear examples just from the end of this term. In Janus, they overruled over 40 years of labor law protections and just said, nope, doesn't matter. Roberts was fully on board with that and did so again with the Muslim ban. If there was a concern about the legitimacy of the institution of the court, the Muslim ban case is, in my opinion, one of those that Roberts really could have nailed home judicial independence. And instead, what he did was author the 5-4 decision that blessed Trump's policy. So I don't feel particularly optimistic about Chief Justice John Roberts.
Just to jump in for a second, what's also super concerning about Justice Roberts is that he's a very smart guy. He's not stupid. And in his decision in the Muslim ban case, you know, he made a big stink about overruling Korematsu because Justice Sotomayor was clearly irritated. And I think Roberts was irritated by her calling him out on Korematsu. So he says, okay, yeah, Korematsu is bad law, and we're finally saying it. You cannot detain people on the basis of race. And the fact that he said on the basis of race and not on the basis of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender, what have you, leaves a wide door open for Trump to begin detaining people on bases other than race. So he can start detaining immigrants, not because they're brown, but because they're immigrants. He can start detaining activists, primarily black and brown activists, not because they're black and brown, but because they're a national security threat. So the fact that he didn't make that particular ruling broader, I think, should concern a lot of people.
I think most listeners know, but let me just remind them that Korematsu is the landmark decision in the 1940s that validated FDR's detention for Japanese Americans on the West Coast. Okay, so I think there is a very big difference between overturning Roe explicitly and allowing states to pass enough crazy anti-choice laws that abortion effectively becomes illegal. And the difference, to my mind, is the backlash that it would engender, right? I mean, the idea of overturning Roe is extremely unpopular with the public. If you just allow states to pass laws like, you know, abortion is legal as long as you have a diamond encrusted, right, like waiting room, and your doctors get trained 8,000 hours or whatever, like these crazy laws that basically regulate abortion away without making it illegal, you know, it seems to me that is something that would result in less outcry. To what degree can they allow those types of restrictions without overturning Roe? In other words, Roe says something pretty specific. It says that states can outlaw abortion with certain exceptions after a certain point. If you pass a ban on abortions after 6 weeks, could they uphold that? Could they uphold a 6-week abortion ban without overturning Roe?
Sure. And I mean, so this is there's a lot to your question.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of misinformation.
I'm really good at long-winded, rambling questions.
It's really important. It's really important because there's a lot to the conversation about throwing Roe back to the states. What does that look like? So let's break it down a little bit. So one possibility would be a very clean decision that says there's no federal constitutional right to an abortion that overturns Roe. What that would do is then take it back to the states, but there is also not a guarantee to a state right to abortion. So sure, you could have 6-week bans that are upheld. You could also have state criminal bans that are upheld because the state could say, well, sorry, you don't actually have a right under our state constitution either. That's one of the reasons why the federal recognition is so important, is because in the context of civil rights laws, what it says is fundamentally, no matter where you travel in this country, your rights as a human being do not change. So your right to reproductive autonomy does not change whether you live in Colorado or California or Alabama or New York. So it's abortion, yes, but what we're talking about is reproductive autonomy. So that's part of it. The court also could, if it got a challenge to, say, a 6-week ban, which are some are in the works already, ostensibly write a decision that both overturns the federal constitutional right to an abortion and simultaneously recognizes the fundamental state interest in protecting life, potential fetal life, is how the court usually has it framed, from the moment of inception or from other places. So the court could in one breath strike Roe and create fetal personhood. Mm-hmm. There's a whole swath of possibility here. And so this is a hobby horse of mine, because you do hear people say, oh, I don't want them to overturn Roe. I believe in abortion rights, but like maybe if it goes back to the states, that's not that bad. It's kind of a compromise. But we don't have a real solid civic understanding of what taking fundamental rights back to the state, particularly in the reproductive context, looks like.
Ugh, God, I've never even seen The Handmaid's Tale. Honestly, I've never seen it. I have no idea what it is, but I know we're living through it. I know we're living mostly from Twitter. All right, so let's talk about, there's this kind of like new savvy thing where Democrats only have 49 seats and, you know, they're not going to be able to block a justice. The Federalist Society has had this list of heinous judges that Trump selected Gorsuch from, and everybody expects him to select somebody from that list. What strategy do you advocate? Let me throw this to Umani. I mean, are you of the opinion that this is a done deal and that, you know, there isn't the possibility of borking this nominee to come?
We're already seeing in the news that Trump is meeting with Democrats like Manchin and Heitkamp, and then also with the pro-choice ladies, Murkowski and Collins. And so, you know, Jessica had a really good piece this week talking about how she thinks that they're going to elevate a woman, this, what's her name, Barrett, to the bench in order to A, have it be a woman that provides that vote to overturn Roe, or at least to restrict abortion rights out of existence, and then B, to call that feminism. But just generally, I am not sure that this slate of Democrats has the stomach to hold together and on top of that, convince two other Republicans to join them. I don't have any faith in this group of Democrats. And I think that has been borne out over the past couple of years, watching some of these Democrats back Trump, back his nominees, back his policies. And I just, you know, when it comes to coalescing around a single message, a single vision, Democrats aren't good at that. Republicans are. And it has really paid off for them. As Jessica said, this has been in the works for decades. And this is literally the realization of all of their dreams. This is the realization of, you know, Operation Rescue, Susan B. Anthony list, just everyone who has been fighting against abortion rights for decades. This is their moment.
It is. They have not been very impressive so far. This idea that you can convince people that Mitch McConnell's so-called McConnell rule, is the issue, that Republican hypocrisy is the issue. This argument is a total loser. People don't care about procedural issues. And what the right has done for years is talk about, you know, how horrible the left-wing justices are going to distort the law and ruin the country. And the Democrats talk about, oh, these like, you know, institutional norms are being violated. It's like, give me a break. Nobody gives a crap about institutional norms except, you know, people in, you know, the Washington Post editorial board. It's extremely frustrating. Before I let you go, what happens, you know, there's been quite a few articles saying let's pack the courts if we retake the House and the Senate and the White House, if we're allowed to vote again. I don't know how all of this nightmare ends. But Jessica, what do you think about this idea of packing the courts? It did not actually work for FDR in terms of enlarging the court, but it scared them into changing the way that they approached his legislation.
I am lukewarm at best on this as an idea. I mean, I appreciate the spirit of the resistance and the willingness to think outside the box. And I mean, yeah, if we want to like blow things up, this falls in line with the idea of, you know, splitting California up into a couple different seats.
Yes,
because that would give us like six new senators, and presumably four of those, I think, would be a safe bet, would be Democratic. I mean, you've got to figure Central California is going to elect a couple Republicans in there should that happen. But, and so, yes, I mean, let's talk about that as a possibility, but that's not going to change the immediate 18 months.
Right.
And it's
right.
not going to do anything to deal with the policies and the realities at hand. And so while that sounds like a, you know, that sounds like a good strategy, it also sounds like a law review paper. And frankly, I'm at the point now where I'm worried about kids getting, you know, jailed and five-year-olds going through deportation proceedings without counsel. You know, these are the realities right now. And so even if we were to get that plan in and we could add more justices and we could pack it, well, then great. Let's presume our democracy has survived for another 100 years and we are at this point again. There is no guarantee that the political tides don't turn and we face this same position. I mean, I think it's important to remember that historically the court has always been a conservative institution. We had a liberal blurb with the Brennan years, but then it's really swung hard to the right with, you know, it went to the right with Rehnquist and then went real hard to the right with Roberts. And so, you know, I'm just encouraging folks to do direct action at this point.
Yeah, that sounds right.
I think the idea that we're going to be able to retake the House, retake the Senate, retake the White House, and then pack the courts, it's a pipe dream. I really think it's a pipe dream. And certainly, as Jessica said, it doesn't do anything for the marginalized and vulnerable people who are going to start suffering now.
I do think that we need to think long term about term limits. And I think that that's something that, you know, you can make an argument that is good for, ultimately good for democracy and a kind of above partisan, you know, kind of thing. You don't want people who are octogenarians constantly, you know, being elected to a position where you end up being not elected, but appointed to a position where you're as powerful as anybody for 50 years or 45 years or whatever. But that is a less radical approach than trying to pack the courts. I want to thank you two for taking the time to speak with me. I really do appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having
me. Yeah, thank you.
Folks, read Amani and Jessica at rewired.news and check out Boom Lawyered. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back. Stay tuned.
My share of hard times too. Well, I lost my faith in the world, honey, when I lost you. Remember the good times we shared together. Don't you want them back again? Though these hard times bugging me now, honey, now it's a sin.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm pleased to have Todd Tucker on the show this week. Todd is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, and he's the author of a new book. It's called Judge Not, and that's not like a knot in a rope, K-N-O-T. Judge Not, Politics and Development in International Investment Law. That's Todd, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. It's been a while since you've been on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Glad to be back.
Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I was planning on having you on next week's show. A guest I had lined up had to cancel at the last minute, so I haven't yet had a chance to read the book. And I want to thank you for stepping in. Tell us a little bit about the book. What is your thesis or your argument?
Yeah, sure. So this is a topic that I've been interested in for many, many years, which is the topic of investor-state dispute settlement, or ISDS. And this is basically a new, you know, relatively new form of legal system that's developed over the last few decades that allows foreign investors, multinational investors, to sue their host state governments outside of national courts. And this is sort of an arbitration-based system that's included in a lot of different treaties and international agreements like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. It's a topic that I've been long interested in. But when I first started kind of getting wind of this in the early 2000s, there was basically no data. It was a system that had existed on paper since the 60s, but there hadn't been a lot of actual cases of, you know, companies going after host governments. And that all changed in the early 2000s and mid-2000s when Argentina went through its big financial crisis in 2001 and 2002. And in the decade prior, you had a lot of U.S. and European companies basically buy up everything in the country, sort of all these privatized companies. And then you had this financial crisis happen, and all of a sudden the government had to sort of step in and restore financial stability. That upset a lot of the companies that were, you know, sort of saw their profits go down as a result of some of that regulation. So they started taking Argentina to arbitration under a lot of these different treaties that the previous kind of neoliberal governments had signed with European countries and with the U.S. So companies like Enron, companies like Total in France, you know, different companies kind of going after and sort of claiming that they sort of saw their future expected profits go down, and therefore Argentine taxpayers needed to be on the hook to make them whole again. So, you know, basically over the course of just a very few years, you went from having almost no cases to now, you know, as of this last year, we have about 900 cases that have been launched. So it kind of went from being this blip on the international scene to becoming you know, a forum that's more active than a lot of national courts, more active than the World Trade Organization and other sort of better known forums. And it's, you know, it's starting to shape politics and economics in a pretty serious way. So that's what the book's about. I went around and interviewed the arbitrators that actually decide these cases in order to get a sense of what makes them tick, what they're in it for, you know, what their sort of overall ideologies are about government regulation. And, you know, it produced some eye-opening results.
Now, just so listeners understand, these things can also be used to, these are generally closed tribunals, and they're distinguished when Todd talks about investor to state dispute resolution. You need to understand that with the WTO, a company has to get their country, their government, to file a claim to go through the WTO's arbitration system. This allows companies to skip that middleman, their governments, and just take sovereign governments to these secretive tribunals, and they can sue them for lost profits over things like environmental regulations. And this is it's a real pernicious shift of governance from elected governments, largely elected governments, and non-elected governments to corporations. So I'm interested in what you found in terms of the ideology of these arbiters. I assume that they are all kind of trade attorneys and people with corporate backgrounds. Is that right?
Well, so a good chunk of them are sort of corporate attorneys, and those are the ones that tend to be appointed by the investors in the case. And that's something I should kind of explain. You have one arbitrator, you know, there's three arbitrators on these panels. One is appointed by the investor, another by the government that's doing the defense, and then a third by sort of agreement between the two arbitrators. So, you know, the kinds of folks that tend to get appointed and reappointed and reappointed on the corporate, you know, on the corporate side do tend to come from a corporate law world. On the state side, they tend to, you know, they're academics or sort of former public servants. You have, you know, this is a quite lucrative kind of post-retirement gig for, you know, Supreme Court judges from around the world, from Sweden and elsewhere. So, you know, they take part as well. And then, you know, the sort of the deciding vote in a lot of these cases is sort of the one that's able to ingratiate themselves to both sides that leads the case. So there is a little bit of variation in, you know, the kinds of people that get into the system. I mean, but some of the things that don't change is that this is a pretty closed community, a pretty specialized group of lawyers that are, you know, making these highly consequential decisions about sort of the shape of rules in a global era. You know, they tend to be very sort of small C conservative, I would say, in their outlook towards social change. So, you know, as long as governments are sort of being fairly consistent across time, as long as, you know, socialist governments hand off to, you know, more neoliberal governments and vice versa, but as long as the policies are fairly consistent, then they don't have, you know, they're not particularly anti-government. Where they start getting into sort of more anti-democratic, anti-government point of view is when there's a lot of change between governments. And, you know, of course, you and I know and your listeners know that, you know, one of the main functions of elections is for candidates to go out there, you know, make their promises, get the people to buy in, to how they would do things different, and then implement that agenda once they're elected. And that was something that a lot of the arbitrators that I talked to were very concerned about. They sort of thought that, you know, if a gold mine is deciding to go in and invest in a Colombia or in El Salvador, they don't want that rule changing over the 20, 30 year time period that you know, they're making that investment in the country. So as long as the governments basically don't change the policy regime, all's good. Once government starts sort of responding to their electorate in a more dynamic way, that's where governments can run into trouble.
Yeah, and I imagine that they are all believers in harmonization of rules and regulations across countries. And this is something that people like you and I have been long critical of, is that conformity is not necessarily a good thing. Governments should have the flexibility to be responsive to their citizens, their unique circumstances, their unique economic distributions, et cetera, et cetera. Todd, I want to switch, while we still have some time, I want to switch tracks a little bit and talk a bit about Trump's approach to trade. You and I have, I think we, the first time we talked about trade was, I was thinking about this the other day, I think it was 14 years ago, which is weird because I'm only like 27. And
and yeah, I'm 25. So yeah,
you're only 25, so it's weird. And we've long been critical of the international trade system as it exists. For someone who doesn't pay attention to these kinds of things, how would you distinguish between a quote-unquote fair trader's critique of this regime and Trump's critique and also prescriptions for reform?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that's been a lot of cognitive dissonance for me over the last couple of years has been the extent to which the Trump critique, and sort of more specifically the critique of people that he's appointed to key positions, like Robert Lighthizer, who is the U.S. Trade Representative, you know, the extent to which there's real overlap with the kinds of things that more left-wing Democrats have been talking about for a long time. So, you know, in the Senate, one of Trump's sort of top trade allies, it's not the people on his own side of the aisle, it's not the Republicans, it's folks like Sherrod Brown from Ohio that are, you know, kind of the quintessential fair trade Democrat. You know, on some of the specifics of the things that Trump's team has recommended, like in the NAFTA renegotiations, it's been stuff, you know, pulled from the talking points of places like Public Citizen, that where I used to work. So it kind of surprised a lot of people that the Trump administration even knew anything about something called investor-state dispute settlement, much less that they had sort of pretty significant reforms that they wanted to make to it, which include, you know, which go beyond sort of what a lot of even sort of Democrats have advocated in the past, basically making the system more optional. So there, I think there's a lot. There's also just a lot of continuity with the kinds of structural challenges that you know, basically whether it was Hillary Clinton or whether it was Donald Trump, there were sort of structural challenges in the global economy, namely sort of the rise of China, that was going to be sort of, you were going to see a pretty consistent approach regardless of the party in power. And it was going to be sort of a bit of a break with the Obama Bill Clinton era to kind of a more sort of new challenges that either candidate would have addressed in broadly similar ways. I mean, I think the big difference is more one of style and it's one of tone. So, you know, I think a Hillary Clinton would have done a lot of back channel diplomacy to our trading partners, would have done a lot of back channel conversations to folks in Congress to try to build a little bit more of a consensus for the approach that they were going to take, you know, in confronting China or in sort of replacing the TPP with the Trans-Pacific Partnership with something else. With Trump, it's just been a lot more about unilateral executive discretion. And, you know, sort of the bad news for people that worry about that kind of thing is that, you know, the administration has a lot of tools that Congress has delegated to it over the years, you know, to past administrations. We're basically, you know, going back to the Eisenhower era, we have trade laws on the books that say, in the event that the president declares a national security situation, he can basically, you know, restrict trade in the way he wants to for the duration of time that he wants to against the countries that he wants to, all without a word from Congress, all without judicial review. And that has, you know, that has obviously that's irked business. That's irked our trading partners. That's irked a lot in Congress. And I mean, you even see sort of people like Sherrod Brown that are otherwise on the same page with administration and a lot of their policies being concerned about how far this goes. So Trump is sort of, you know, a little while ago has imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum using this national security justification. And then he's also now floating putting those kind of tariffs on autos as well, kind of saying that it's a national security and economic security imperative to keep Detroit humming along. So, it's not new that a U.S. president would care about the auto industry, but what is new is kind of the way he's going about it and sort of the heavy reliance on trade instead of other kind of tools like taxing the rich to pay for an industrial policy. And instead, he's kind of, you know, while cutting taxes and cutting tax rates, essentially, you know, forcing the cost of a kind of a new industrial policy almost entirely on our trading partners. So that's something that's a little different a President Sherrod Brown or a President Hillary Clinton would have approached those things in a different way, not to mention a President Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders.
You know, one thing that I think is different is that to a large degree, our focus has been on what are known as non-tariff barriers. And Trump is obsessed with tariffs, and he's also, it seems to me, and this is, you know, I don't know, I don't want to get inside his head and speculate about exactly what he knows and doesn't know, but it largely seems to be this like impulsive way of punishing his perceived enemies, right? I mean, that the steel tariffs are a sop to the base, but they are also a giant middle finger to the Western Alliance by including it when he justified it, but through Chinese steel. Now you extend it to Canada and Europe. Just on Friday, by the way, Canada announced $12.6 billion in retaliatory tariffs that it's levying against U.S. exports to Canada, imports from the U.S., I guess, to Canada. And this strikes me as a significant difference. Todd, I believe we are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, and especially on such short notice.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Folks, the book is called Judge Not. That's K-N-O-T. It is out from Anthem Press, and I'm going to read it, and I hope you do too. I'd also like to thank John Amato, Jessica Mason Piclo, Amani Gandhi for joining us. And you can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can write an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you get your podcasts. I'd also like to thank Smirking Chimp, Crooks and Liars, and Hullabaloo, Digby's Place, for letting me host the show at their respective joints. Of course, I'd like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week. He's gonna end up on the dirty boulevard. He's going out to the dirty boulevard. He's going down to the dirty boulevard. Room costs $2,000 a month. You can believe it, man, it's true. Somewhere a landlord's laughing till he wets his pants. No one dreams of being a doctor or a lawyer or anything. They dream of dealing on the dirty boulevard.